The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've got AI technology, you've got fast computer technology, and you've got big data. And all of that together, from the perspective of an adversary, makes a very lucrative target. And so, and as we go forward with 5G and Internet of Things, and as more and more data is collected, that trove of information is going to be even richer and even more desirable for an adversary to obtain. And most likely that will be done through malicious cyber activities. And so I think it, when I start to think about that, I become depressed because our cybersecurity posture is so grim, quite frankly. And so the incentives for the adversaries to go after those kinds of assets, their abilities, their resources are quite substantial.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, June 19th, 2018. From manufacturing to healthcare and from criminal justice to national security, artificial intelligence is changing nearly every sector of the global economy and many aspects of our public and private lives. Security is no exception. And as artificial intelligence technology races ahead, its political, legal, and ethical considerations cannot be left undiscussed. Last Tuesday, as part of the A. Alfred Taubman Forum on Public Policy, James Baker, Susan Hennessy, and Scott Towsley joined John Allen at the Brookings Institution to discuss the opportunities AI offers and the challenges it presents to security. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 322, Artificial Intelligence and Security.
So let's talk first and foremost about the tactical to the strategic. AI has the capacity to drastically impact virtually every aspect of our national security as a concept, but also in the apparatus. Let me just ask each one of the members of the panel, from your perspective, how will AI most change the way we think about national security? Jim, could we start with you?
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it. So in terms of how AI will most drastically change things with respect to national security, I think we don't really know, and I think that's one of the things that concerns me the most. It seems to be a very powerful technology. The answer is we really don't know, I think. In terms of sort of thinking about my background and the kinds of things I've worked on, counterintelligence, surveillance, cybersecurity, I think in those fields, it could substantially revolutionize how we approach those types of issues, how we approach data, how we understand and analyze data, and how we then deploy investigative resources as a result of that. So what do I mean by that? For example, one thing I think that we have to think about, and I'm sure that we're not quite ready to deal with this, is in terms of using AI, for example, to understand and analyze the investigative holdings, for example, that the FBI and other agencies have, to utilize AI tools to look at and look for patterns, relationships, within what it is that we have already. We have a lot. Speaking of the FBI, still in the present, the FBI has a lot of investigative holdings from a variety of different sources, including from electronic surveillance And I think utilizing AI to understand and analyze that potentially could have huge benefits for us, but it raises a number of privacy, mainly I think privacy and issues with respect to the Constitution and making sure that what's done is in strict adherence to the Constitution and laws of the United States. So I think that's an area that would be, I think, highly significant for us. And I think we need to give a lot of thought to that. I think lawyers need to spend a lot of time thinking about that, and happy to chat about that more as we go here.
And I think that's a hot burner issue, frankly, for us these days. Scott, any of your thoughts, please?
Yes, sir. Thank you for the chance to be here. My boss, Doug Maughan, got called away, so I'm sort of stepping in here for him. And I also want to give a shout out to Mike Harris, who I work with at NIST and in a lot of these areas and stuff, another serious expert in this space. We don't know exactly how it will play out, but it's pretty obvious it will have significant, huge impacts in multiple different areas. You know, we've seen a lot of cases already over the last decade, especially the back and the forth of offensive techniques of cyber activity versus defensive. And it's pretty clear AI can help both ends of that, which is both good and bad. It's a double-edged sword, like so many of these technologies and technical capabilities and concepts and explorations turn out to be. This is maybe one of the most significant breakthrough areas that's taking place in a globalized world where lots of money is going into this that is not in the United States. And that gets really interesting because it's not just our social science, policy, legal questions getting folded into the tech capabilities. It's also different experiments being done, Germany, South Korea, Australia, Russia, China, you name it. And so everybody's experimenting with it in a social way, not just a technical way. And so we've got to be really attuned to what's being experimented, tried out, piloted. And that's a topic that's pretty significant to me in a science and tech organization, where we've got to think of this in an engineering, let's try some things way, not because we've settled the policy, but in a lot of cases you have to park the policy while you explore to see what even makes sense to do it. And we're naturally pretty good at engineering things and trying stuff out. It's harder to convince people that when there's people involved and there's policy and legal and all sorts of other issues involved, that you still have to try the same experimentation.
Sure.
But it's clearly going to have a big impact in lots of different areas.
Thank you. Thank you. Susan?
Yeah, so I largely agree, right, that this is all a double-edged sword. There's going to be good and bad. Sort of on the positive side, I think it does have the ability to sort of revolutionize speed, capacity, the ability to detect patterns, not just sort of augmenting human capacity, but really going beyond what we ever could have possibly imagined. It's also going to introduce entirely new forms of vulnerabilities. And we're going to have to think not just about sort of the promise of AI and machine learning, but also sort of what's known as adversarial machine learning. So deploying these systems when there is an attacker or sort of in the presence of somebody who wants to manipulate them for bad. So Don Song, who's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, has done some really interesting and rather scary research, if anybody out there wants to get their pulse racing in the morning, on what this sort of adversarial machine learning might look like. So some of her experiments have shown, for example, how easy it would be to modify a stop sign such that for a human who was looking at a stop sign, it would look like an ordinary stop sign. To an autonomous vehicle system, it would actually become entirely invisible. So whenever we start to think about the ability to manipulate objects in the physical world in ways that can have really, really dramatic consequences, I think that's a sort of a little taste of the kinds of security challenges that we're going to be facing here, that not only are we moving deeper and deeper sort of into the cyberspace, but we also need to care about the kinetic world as well.
Very good. Now, Scott, you spend a good bit of time in the whole business of cybersecurity. And we know that, as Susan properly said, and I think it's a very important point to recognize, the speed at which things will occur will be revolutionary. In fact, you'll hear the term now hyperwar in the context of how fast conflict can both unfold and be prosecuted. But there's also a real implication for that in the context of the cyber domain and protecting and acting in the cyber domain in terms of cybersecurity. Can you give us some of your thoughts on that, please?
We fund a lot of applied research efforts trying to improve capabilities that CIOs and CISOs have within DHS the federal world generally and the critical infrastructure world. And it's common already for elements of AI to be folded into something that somebody's doing that may actually serve to protect an emergency call center or protect against a DDoS attack or all sorts of other things. So the AI elements are percolating into the applications, the use, the explorations in lots of different areas, and that's going to obviously continue. I think the other interesting thing is that we're only still partway through the really large mashup of historically information technology things with the unfolding operating technology changes across the different infrastructures, Internet of Things applications, the pervasive censoring of everything everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so AI is really just the analytics and the insight while everybody is still trying to understand. A decade ago, I was trained on how to manage a water plant by managing things that were there. And now you can almost autonomously do it, and figuring out how to do that in a safe and secure way, ways that the insurance companies are happy with, all those sorts of things. And so AI is really just a significant layering of learning and application on how to do that. And that is the one thing I think that helps us a little bit, is that all of our systems are so heterogeneous that that gives us a little bit of a break and or a governor on the AI stuff that, that helps us, you know, keep an eye on where it's going to go and how it's going to help us manage things in the right ways.
Good. Thank you. And either other panels?
Sure. In terms of cybersecurity, I agree with that. It presents a lot of different novel challenges. It strikes me that, first of all, AI, to think about AI, at least from a perspective of a lawyer, right? So keep in mind, I'm not a technologist, but when I think about it, I think about it as part of the much larger digital ecosystem. So it doesn't exist on its own somewhere out there, right? It's it exists on technology. It exists on computers, and the faster, the better, I think, at least in terms of how it is able to operate. And it also then, as we've sort of touched on, it helps analyze data in ways that we've been chatting about, but it also, I'll use the term, feeds off of data, right? It learns from data. It needs to be exposed to data. The algorithms need to be exposed to data sets, and that raises all kinds of issues in terms of biases and so on. Mm-hmm. So with that, you've got AI technology, you've got fast computer technology, and you've got big data. And all of that together, from the perspective of an adversary, makes a very lucrative target.
That's right.
And so, and as we go forward with 5G Internet of Things, and as more and more data is collected, that trove of information is going to be even richer and even more desirable for an adversary to obtain. And most likely that will be done through malicious cyber activities. Mm-hmm. And so I think it, when I start to think about that, I become depressed because our cybersecurity posture is so grim, quite frankly. And so the incentives for the adversaries to go after those kinds of assets, their abilities, their resources are quite substantial, and that will, you know, we've already seen the erosion of U.S. technical edge, loss of intellectual property, loss of money, those kinds of things that have harmed the country. And so I think the desire for adversaries to obtain that information is even going to be greater, because I think they understand also how revolutionary this technology is. And if they don't keep up with us,
sure,
they're going to be in a bad way. So they have a substantial incentive to try to steal that kind of stuff.
And we've recently been declared the most cyber vulnerable society on the planet. And so this is a really important issue at this particular moment. Susan, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think that whenever we think about sort of the problems we have been unable to solve, systemically insecure software, the ability to sort of bring it up even to minimal standards, this AI starts to sort of pose a really interesting potential solutions in that space. Because we have sort of insufficient regulatory frameworks, because
That's
of
right.
the first to market incentives, other things, it might be that trying to build secure software at the, at the front end, we throw up our hands and say that's not possible. What we have seen whenever we actually see these AI tools deployed is the ability of machine learning systems to go out, sort of in capture the flag type simulations, go out, identify vulnerabilities in other systems, learn how to exploit them, come back to their own systems, identify that same vulnerability in themselves, and then patch it, right? So we're seeing now this continuous loop, things that can happen without any human intervention whatsoever. I think what we're heading towards is a system in which then it depends on sort of the how asymmetric the broader landscape is. So you're naturally going to have a race in that space as things get hopefully better and better, more and more secure. But it's why I think we're seeing so much anxiety, especially in the United States right now, about our perceived lack of a strategic edge here. Sort of the first to dominate this technology really is going to be able to set a lot of the broader rules. And so some of the early indications that we might be lagging behind, I think that does have really troubling long-term implications, in part because we don't really know where any of this is going to go, and we don't necessarily understand the technology itself.
And I think as we see, to your point, the improvement of dynamic cognitive defensive systems, which in very real sense, given the speeds involved here, where we have cognitive systems who are seeking to breach a network while we have cognitive systems operating against it seeking to defend the network. This is a very intriguing dimension, I think, of the whole business of cybersecurity as it evolves. Now, for those of you who have taken notice, we're doing a lot of writing here at Brookings and a number of public events. We're going to do a lot more in the near future. One of the things that's very important to us here at Brookings, and Jim and Susan, I'll ask you to comment first, and Scott, you can come in behind it, is the whole issue of an acronym, which I'm sure for those of you who are familiar with this community are familiar with. It's called ELSI, which stands for the Ethical, Legal, and Societal Implications of Artificial Intelligence and the Community of Technologies Associated with it. It really needs to define much of who we are as a people and what we seek to achieve with respect to the implications and the employment of artificial intelligence. Let me just ask, Jim, in the capacity, both you and Susan, in your long careers within the law and as having been general counsels, what are you thinking about when you hear about those ethical issues, ethical, legal, and societal issues?
Right. So as general counsel, I was one of the main parts of my job was to worry. And I worried a lot.
Made you a very good general counsel. Yeah, thank you.
Yes. So anyway, so I worry about a lot about those kinds of things. So I worry about, let me just highlight two things. One is to make sure, for example, that an agency like the Bureau is, when it's using AI, it's using it in ways that are explainable and ethical and consistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. And so to make sure that we're buying products that we understand what's happening. Again, I'm speaking the present, it's the past, but anyway, that the Bureau and other government agencies are buying products that they understand, that they can explain, that they can defend in court, that they can defend to Congress and the American people, and that are consistent with all of our values, right? So that's one of the most important things. Because, well, we don't want to show up in court with bad AI. We don't want to send scarce investigative resources chasing after leads that's based on some type of bad algorithm or bad application of an algorithm, because it says these people are the ones that you need to worry about. These are the most likely terrorists, for example. And you devote a lot of resources. What the FBI is limited in terms of how many resources it has. So I worry substantially about that. So the Bureau and other government agencies need to make sure that they have in place mechanisms to make sure that they're buying the best AI. I do worry significantly about what adversaries will do, mm-hmm. and whether their values will be the same as ours when it comes to ethical and explainable AI. They may not care that they understand how it works so long as it produces a result that they like. And they may be willing to tolerate sort of, I'll call it collateral damage, damage to people, damage to institutions, damage to innocent individuals, that to their minds is an acceptable cost given the highly beneficial result that they're obtaining from this black box AI that they can't really understand. And I'm concerned that that will put pressure on us to try to keep pace with them.
Right.
That their AI in even if it has a lot of negative externalities, so to speak, if it's producing something really good for them and they're pushing forward with that, that's going to put pressure on us. And whether we can keep up with that, with our AI. If our AI is explainable and ethical, it's probably going to be better in the long run, and will prevail in the long run. But it's going to be, I think, challenging to try to keep up with the adversaries if they're willing to go down this route.
Susan, your thoughts? That's a really important, I'll come back to that, Jim. Thank you.
Yeah, so I do think that it's going to pose really tremendous legal challenges, in part because, sort of our legal structure is predicated on being able to hold someone accountable for making a decision. And as we, as fewer and fewer human beings actually make decisions, it's going to be more and more difficult. Who can we ultimately hold accountable, right? If you go back to the designer of the system, is it the person who created the training sets?
Right.
Is it the person who deployed it, who didn't notice compliance mechanisms? Right? We're really going to need to think through, kind of the core framework here of how exactly we're going to regulate and think about law and responsibility in this space. I think in some ways, though, the more difficult or sort of vexing challenge is going to be those broader ethical concerns. And whenever we think about training sets, for example, we know that it's possible to introduce bias, right? So whatever goes in is what comes out. On one hand, that might be a point of vulnerability. Somebody might manipulate training sets intentionally. Mm-hmm. We might also unintentionally manipulate training sets. So one of the most sort of influential and important AI data training sets is the Enron emails. Just these 1.6 million emails that were released by the FERC after the Enron case.
Sure.
for transparency reasons. It's a huge free trove of data of human beings talking to each other. It is really invaluable. And so lots and lots of researchers have used it in their work just because it's there. Now, if we step back for a minute and think of the values and the choices and the assumptions about human expectations and behaviors we would want these systems to have, is the behavior of Enron employees in 2000, is that the model that we want to put into these systems? And so we really do, the technology is moving at such an incredibly fast pace that it's difficult to sort of say, hey, let's stop and take a step back and think about what we're doing here. I think ultimately this sort of leads to a need for transparency, right? The need to understand what is going into these systems in order to understand what is coming out of them. That fundamentally is in tension with security, because as people understand these systems more and more, they're going to understand how to manipulate them potentially in negative ways more and more. And so we are going to really need to think through what we care the most about, because there really is a risk here of not only introducing this sort of bias, but formalizing it and hardening it in ways that are going to be really difficult to sort of unwind later.
Mm. It's pretty tough. Scott?
A big part of me is a little more optimistic than parts of that. This is a huge challenge in communication of science and technology and its implications. One of the most profound talks I ever heard was one given by Alan Alda at a AAAS meeting some years ago. He's got a center at Stony Brook that specializes in how to communicate science with the public.
Mm-hmm.
We've all seen TED Talks that are really very insightful. When the edge isn't there, they're just talking about trying to explain it. You know, I remember vividly the testimony of Richard Feynman at the Challenger Commission. We need to find ways to explain what's being tried, how it worked, what didn't work, in a way that makes it simple for people to follow and simply trust the citizenry and our country to do it. And it's we're a fractious place. De Tocqueville talked about that. But there are strengths to that sort of thing. And this is a technology that everybody on the globe is going to be experimenting with. And that's actually going to be a huge strength, because we'll see what works and doesn't work in a European place versus a South American place versus an Asian place or whatever. And then we can sort of draw our conclusions and listen and learn from that. And I think that actually is a significant strength to this technology and our choices in how to employ it.
So Google this week issued a document where it takes a position in that document that none of the work that Google will perform will either support the development of the weaponization of AI for weapon systems or for surveillance purposes. So we're talking about that. We're talking about the ethics of AI, the ethical, the legal, the societal implications. we have a major tech company that has taken a social and policy position with respect to its willingness to participate in AI for the purposes of national security. And then we have the issue of global competition. And I think we know that there will be those who seek to adopt and adapt the algorithms of artificial intelligence with supercomputing and access to big data that may not otherwise be so constrained by ethics as we are. And when, as Susan said early along, as one of the key aspects of this international competition is both speed of development and speed of employment. What are your thoughts about this? Where are we right now as we move into the digital future with respect to these intersecting lines of tech giants being unwilling to participate in national security with respect to AI, the inherent flow of resources and commitment by certain nations to the development of these capabilities? Where do you think we stand? Scott, let's go back to you, since you're part of the government now.
Absolutely. I think it's still early in this evolution of how this is going to work. I understand the Google statement and position. There is a need for transparency. Again, as somebody steeped in technology, it's a problem for me not to try and experiment, show people what did or didn't work, how it was set up, be able to go back to it later and talk about it in a fairly dispassionate way. And clearly, AI, there are huge human systems, social elements to all this, but we still have to try and figure out how to experiment because the experimentation contributes to the decisions about how to ultimately make it work. And there are lots of companies that, you know, are still playing in the space and supporting the government, working with, and the government's still trying to figure out how to run these experiments and where the boundaries ought to be. And the Google statement, I think, contributes to that discussion of we don't want to just blindly support everything, but we want to think about that. So I think in the end, it'll work out pretty solidly as long as we have an open mind to it, an open technical and purpose mind, and we explain things about why we're trying to do it and think of them in experimental senses, in demonstration activities, in engineering problems and analysis and things like that, because that's really where we're at in a lot of these cases.
Jim, any thoughts?
Sure. So I think you would definitely know better than I do, but the military implications of AI are vast, and we're not going to be able to cover that right
profound.
Now, but they're profound, they're substantial, and a lot of money is being invested in that in the United States and around the globe. I'm quite confident that there will be, if it's not Google, there will be other contractors that step up and fulfill that role with respect to the U.S. military, the militaries of our allies and our adversaries as well. And that's the point, I think, that we are going to, if companies don't want to deal with or don't want to participate in the production of those kinds of products, I guess I'll call them, our adversaries will, and so the United States will have to figure out how to deal with that. So we're going to have to figure out some way to develop that type of technology to the benefit of our military in a way that's consistent with our values and U.S. policy, because that's the world that we're going to live in.
Thank you.
Yep. That's the main point, I think.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Susan.
Yeah, so this isn't the first time that we've had to sort of confront the issue of dual-use technologies. And so I think in some ways this is novel, in some ways it's not novel. I can speak less to sort of the weapons element of this, but as a former member of the intelligence community, as we think about sort of the surveillance tools, clearly there is a capacity for harm here. But whenever large companies decide sort of just not to participate, I think two things end up happening. One, you forfeit the ability to actually shape these technologies, and I think it is an accurate prediction that this doesn't mean these systems aren't going to be built. It means they aren't going to be built by you. And so by sort of as a threshold matter, just saying, hey, you know, we're not going to operate in this space, that might be a reasonable choice to make, but you are giving up the ability to sort of bake in some of your values there. I also think whenever we think about sort of the surveillance context specifically, there's a little bit of an assumption, especially from technology companies right now to discuss U.S. surveillance and U.S. national security, surveillance for U.S. national security purposes, as sort of necessarily an evil, right? It is not a neutral technology that can be used for both good and evil, but instead it is sort of is a bad thing. And I think that is a little bit of a shame, in part because, you know, the intention of the U.S. intelligence community is to make the world safer for people and ideas. And I understand that's a controversial position, but that really is supposed to be the core of what we're working towards. One of the core issues that we've had in the U.S. surveillance debate has been discussions about privacy. How do we protect the privacy of Americans and innocent individuals abroad while also allowing them to conduct this sort of critical mission? One tremendous potential use here is the ability to use AI in order to minimize privacy intrusions, right? Have fewer people looking at personal information, ensuring that we are only looking at that which is strictly necessary, right? Mm-hmm. So there actually is a lot of ability to sort of maximize privacy values, potentially sort of that mythical space in which we don't have to give up privacy for security, this thing that we've all sort of been discussing really just aspirationally. This is the technology that potentially starts to move us there in a real way. And so I take the concerns here. I think they're real and they shouldn't be minimized, but I do worry sort of as a threshold matter of just saying, hey, you know, we're not going to allow any systems to be built or used in this way. I worry that we're leaving a lot of good on the table by doing that.
The points that you all of you have made, which are very important, is that this is going to be a crucial consideration as we move forward. The whole business of dual use AI algorithms, the improvement of supercomputing, the access to data, the scope of which we can only now begin to imagine, it really forces us to have to come to grips with these whole ethical issues. And that's completely apart from a conversation I don't want to get into today, but it deserves our continued consideration. And that is the whole business of autonomous weapons systems and the capacity of the United States to wield these systems in a hyperwar environment where there is theoretically, no human in the loop. And I'm not talking about a U.S. human in the loop. I'm talking about in the theory of where in the process of autonomous systems, where weapon systems are employed at an ethical level, is the human in the loop to ensure that we remain true to our values. That's really the pivot point of much of this conversation. And all of you have touched that in one form or another. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had, I think, a very stimulating panel. We have touched on some, I think, central issues that we're going to have to address as we move forward with the embrace of not just artificial intelligence, but emerging technologies of the 21st century. The speed of development, the speed of innovation, the speed of employment of these kinds of systems is going to have to require or going to be aided in a very real way by public policy research institutions to help the technical organizations to bridge the gap with the governmental organizations so we can have laws and regulations and policies that bring us along as a people consistent with our values as we embrace this technology. Let me ask you to help me thank this great panel this morning, and we'll move on quickly to the next. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the podcast on Twitter or Facebook and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. Our audio editor is Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.